May it please the Court, Jeremy Delosino appearing on behalf of the appellant Matthew Stewart. This case is about 6 milliliters, the amount roughly of a prescribed dose of GHB taken by individuals suffering from sleep disorders, the amount of roughly the foam on top of a perfectly poured pint of Guinness, or since we're in San Francisco, the amount of foam on the top of a perfectly poured pint of Ankerstein. 6 milliliters is the amount that Matthew Stewart distributed, 6 milliliters of GHB in this case. And for those 6 milliliters, again, roughly one dose or potentially the amount of foam on a beer, Matthew Stewart received a sentence of a decade in federal prison. Put simply and without hyperbole, such a sentence is unreasonable. The district court in this case abused what is admittedly a large and wide range of discretion afforded to sentencing judges. But nonetheless, Matthew Stewart asks this court to find such a sentence substantively unreasonable. Matthew Stewart was not a large-scale drug distributor, as he's been characterized by the government, in both in the proceedings in front of the district court and in the briefing submitted to this court. Matthew Stewart was an individual that took 6 milliliters of GHB and spread it among 11.3 liters, roughly 3 to 3.5 gallons of water. What he essentially did was dilute all of the GHB, the one dose, among 3 gallons of water. Matthew Stewart was, for lack of a better description, a cheat, but not what we would think of as a large-scale drug distributor. Congress had in mind, when it passed legislation directing the Sentencing Commission to put the guidelines as high as the statutory maximum for career offenders, Congress had in mind large-scale drug distribution, large-scale distributors with a history of drug distribution, not at a street level, but a larger level. Matthew Stewart did not fit the bill. The district court in this case, however, relied on the sentencing guidelines and the range prescribed by those guidelines in imposing its sentence.
You're not contesting that he properly relied on the guidelines, are you?
I'm contesting not that he relied on the guidelines, but the weight that he gave to the guidelines.
No, I understand. But the guidelines are written that way, i.e., it's the solution that matters.
Exactly. And so when we look to the substantive reasonableness, one of the reasons that the appellant has set forth in his brief a table of the applicable guidelines, if guideline of career offender did not apply, is to gauge the substantive reasonableness of the sentence ultimately imposed. And what we have in page 35 of the brief is a table. If Matthew Stewart had only been held responsible for the 6 milliliters of GHB, even with the two prior convictions, his sentencing guideline range would have been 0 to 6 months. But if we assume that he's held responsible, as the guidelines direct the sentencing court to do, for the entire 11.3 liters, the 3.5 gallons of GHB, notwithstanding the fact that there were only 6 milliliters of GHB in
Does that include
those
what was found in his house?
No. Yes.
It does?
It includes all of the amounts. Now, the tests that were done were only done on a couple of samples, but the two samples that they were done, the purity was 0.04% and 0.05%. Not 4 and 5%, but 1/20th of 1%. If he had been held responsible for the entire 11.3 liters, the guidelines, even with the two prior criminal history, two prior convictions for distribution, the guidelines would have been 46 to 57 months. In this case, the sentencing range, because of the application of the career offender provision, tripled the guideline range. The guideline range became 151 to 188 months. What we're asking this court to do, what Matthew Stewart is asking this court to do, is to look at that guideline range and recognize that it produces a substantively unreasonable sentence.
Except that the district court in this case went below the guidelines, right?
The district court did.
So the district court exercised its discretion, looked at the guideline range, and went below it.
And the district court did. And just because the district court exercised its discretion and took into consideration some of the 3553A factors does not mean that it placed the appropriate weight on those factors. And I think that's the role that this court can take. This court can look at the weight placed on each individual factor and decide whether it can bear the weight of a 10-year sentence for what is effectively a nominal or trivial amount of GHB. Again, the amount that one would have on an overnight dose for someone with a sleeping disorder.
But the court, when we're talking about substantively unreasonable, we don't just hang up on what you've emphasized. The court looked at a history of this defendant's conduct, and he said, you know, he has demonstrated a willingness to engage in criminal conduct. He's told me time and time again he's a good person. He doesn't do bad things. I mean, this district judge took into account who he had before him and the totality of circumstances. So how do we fault Judge George for substantive unreasonableness?
I think we can look to whether the court placed an undue emphasis on a guideline provision that has been assailed by academics, criticized by courts, and called into question by the Sentencing Commission itself.
It wasn't the main reason that the guideline range was as high as it was because of the career offender.
It is entirely the reason why the guideline
range. But the career offender, but this whole thing that you're putting emphasis on now, was not the reason for the career offender. It was the two priors.
It was indeed the two priors. But I guess what I'm saying is that deference to a guideline that's been roundly criticized by a number of sources, whether they be judges, academics, is improper when we have a result that produces such an anomalous sentence.
So this is a different problem that you're now talking about. It's not the fact that this was extremely diluted GHB, but now you're talking about the career offender guideline. That's different.
Well, it's but one factor. I think that the low level of purity goes to the substantive reasonableness of the sentence. The reliance on career offender provision, which has been roundly criticized by a number of sources, that also goes to the reasonableness of the sentence. And so
the fact that academics criticize the career offender guidelines that are in place means we ignore it?
No.
So what's your point?
Well, academics have criticized, but it's not just academics.
Well,
courts around the country.
Courts criticize whatever, but it's there.
It is. But when we have a guideline that is predicated on two prior criminal history convictions, to the exclusion of all other relevant factors, or to the exclusion of most other relevant factors, I think we can have a sentence
but
that's
the district court
reasonable.
Here, did. I mean, he would have had authority to disregard it. He knew that. He said so. Right? He considered the question whether to rely on this guideline. And then he sort of partly did and partly didn't.
And he did. He acknowledged that he had the ability to take that into consideration.
Right.
The point that we're raising in this appeal is that the amount of deference that's given to the commission was too high. The result was substantively unreasonable. Surely there must be a set of circumstances in which a sentence, even though it's below the guideline range, can still be substantively unreasonable. That's what we're asking the court to find in this instance. We're asking this court to look at a number of factors, the low purity of the GHB, basically the trivial amount of drugs distributed in this case, or attempted to be distributed in this case, and find that 120 months poorly serves the sentencing goals set forth in 3553A.
Do you want to reserve?
I'd like to reserve, if I could reserve 90
yes.
seconds. Thank you.
Go ahead.
Peter Levitt for the United States, Your Honor. The district court in this case carefully considered the totality of the record evidence, including the defendant's proffered arguments, the defendant's protracted criminal history, the 3553A factors, and all the other evidence and letters submitted by the defendant at sentencing. And based on this, the district court acted well within its broad discretion in conferring what the court correctly and aptly called a gift, 31 months below the low end of the advisory guideline range, in sentencing the defendant not to the low end of 151, but to 120 months in prison. And this court should affirm that substantively reasonable sentence. Congress did not have in mind large-scale distributors when it necessarily have in mind large-scale distributors when 994H and the guidelines that implemented its policy of at or near the statutory maximum was demanded. Rather, Congress had in mind precisely what we have here.
Apparently, Attorney General Holder is in Congress today testifying about ways to redo the sentencing guidelines with regard to drug offenses, perhaps for this reason.
That may be the case, Your Honor. However, I don't believe that recidivist felony drug traffickers are going to be affected. I've been dealing quite a bit with the crack cocaine resentencings under 3582C2, and there's a world of difference between that type of context and this type of context. This is the type of context where Stewart is the last person in the world who should be having anything to do with GHB, no matter how diluted. He sold 5 tablets of ecstasy to an undercover cop. He was about to sell 100 tablets to the undercover cop, and he's convicted. He sells a few grams of powder cocaine to an undercover cop. He sells more powder cocaine to an undercover cop. He's about to sell 2 ounces, negotiates for 2 ounces, $2,600 deal to the undercover cop, and he's convicted again. In this case, he sells a little bit of GHB. Then for $1,700, he sells 9 bottles of GHB, and he's negotiating the sale of 16 bottles of GHB when he's arrested. This is precisely whom the career offender guidelines are supposed to be targeting. And Judge Berzon is correct that the advisory guideline range is determined not based on quantity under 2D1.1, but rather under this specially crafted guideline, 4B1.1, the career offender guideline, precisely for defendants like Stewart's. One doesn't get a break for selling impure or bad drugs. You weigh the solution. Just like in the methamphetamine case, you take according
to... I mean, at one level, that doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because the reason why we're prescribing drugs is because they're going to hurt people or they're going to cause social damage. And if they're essentially incapable of doing that, then one does wonder why. The statute's written, the guidelines are written that way, but I do wonder why. At some point, somebody drinking the solution is just not going to have any impact. There's a scam involved, but aside from that, why are we prescribing this?
We're prescribing it, Your Honor, I would submit, because it only takes a small amount or a weak amount to ruin one woman's life.
But nobody suggested that this amount was that amount.
That's correct, Your Honor. Just like if somebody sells 2 pounds of methamphetamine at only 1% purity, we don't give that person a break, while conversely...
Well, I understand that. I'm questioning it. I understand that that's the case.
I would imagine that at some point, and we've not reached that point in this particular case, the dose would become incapable of doing anything. But that's not the argument here.
There had to be some amount in the... liquid, didn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Is there some measurable amount? If it had been zero, then there wouldn't be a crime committed.
Then we would have perhaps the counterfeit drug.
Yeah, it would be a fake
section of the...
You'd be dealing with misrepresentation or false...
Correct.
Pretenses or whatever. But since he put some in, it was enough to clear whatever requisite threshold there is to make it a criminal act.
Yes, Your Honor. By defendant's own calculations, it's over 6 grams of actual GHB. And nobody is denying that that's enough to achieve nefarious effects. The argument, as I understand it...
Well, I thought counsel was suggesting it was just like selling the foam off of a beer. So are you saying you disagree that it could have had some effect, even if it was just the foam on a beer?
I do, Your Honor. I do disagree. I'm not aware of any study that says if somebody ingests 6.2 grams of GHB, they're going to react.
Yeah, but that would be physically impossible because it was in the 6.2 grams was in how many different bottles of water?
About 11 gallons.
Yes, you have to drink 11 gallons of water. That's not going to happen. So it's basically physically impossible.
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. I would note, however, that at issue is the substantive reasonableness of the sentence, a 31-month below low end of the guideline sentence. We're not in a situation where we're dealing with an Eighth Amendment claim or anything like that. We're assessing substantive reasonableness. And on this record, as the district court considered all of the record evidence and the statutory sentencing factors and said to this defendant, you've been doing stupid things all your life, I don't want to hear about what a good guy you are, and gave him a 31-month gift. That sentence, I would respectfully submit, should be affirmed.
If I could share one passage from the Tenth Circuit from former Judge McConnell in criticizing or at least commenting on the career offender guideline. Judge McConnell wrote in the Pruitt decision, it follows the district court should not be overly shy about concluding that particular defendants, even if third-time drug sellers, do not have the profile.
He wasn't overly shy. He considered it and he didn't do it. I mean, it seems to me your stronger point is the other one, i.e., at what point is it unreasonable to rely on the guidelines with regard to severely diluted drugs?
And in this instance, if Matthew Stewart had sold drugs that were 100% pure, clearly presenting a much more pronounced danger, the guidelines would be the same. If he had sold almost 10 times the amount of 100% pure.
Was there any evidence in the record as to whether the amount of drugs in these solutions that one could reasonably drink could have had any impact?
Nothing in the record that would suggest that. I
want to know whether you had evidence that it couldn't.
Only that the purities were so low that they would have, as Your Honor pointed out, it would have been impossible to consume that six milliliters,
right, but,
which is
but,
a prescribed
I mean,
dose.
But suppose it was, you know, a gallon, the amount in a gallon. Do we know that couldn't have had an impact on someone?
Other than conjecture, no, Judge. There was nothing in the record.
Right.
I would suggest that when we have a situation where the guideline range was 46 to 57 months absent career offender application and it triples, that what we have is a situation ripe for a substantive reasonableness claim.
Or are you suggesting that that's going to become a per se standard? If it triples the unenhanced crime guideline, then that's sort of the benchmark, so the district judges in exercising their discretion will be constrained by that formulation?
No, Judge, I'm mindful of the court's unwillingness to look at bright line rules like that in most cases, and I wouldn't suggest that in every case a tripling of the guideline range should trigger less deferential review, but I do think in this case less deferential review of a guideline range that's predicated on all of these failings that have been discussed by so many sources and predicated on the amount of drugs here, that is nominal amount, should be subject to less deferential review.
Envisioning trying to craft that rule,
I'm sorry.
I'd like a lot more guidance or precision in how one would formulate that rule. Is may not be per se, but it would sure be difficult to draft a guidance where the district courts are now supposed to look at academic criticism and the like. I think Judge McConnell decided to go teach because he didn't find it as rewarding to be in our position.
Yeah, and it's no different than what probably followed the Kimbrough decision, where courts who are equipped with hearing all of these disparate sources of information and weighing them have to take things into account. And that's what we'd ask the Court to do in this instance.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. The case is heard to be submitted for decision.